Professor Oded Lifshitz from the Department of Archaeology and Ancient Near Eastern Cultures at Tel Aviv University is inviting you to join him to a journey following those who composed the historical descriptions in the Hebrew Bible.
The Untold Story of the Kingdom of Judah, Part D. The Untold Stories of the Kingdom of Israel, Chapter 9. The story about Joash, king of Israel, that was partially told, but not quite in the right place. The king of Israel was enslaved to Aram Damascus throughout the entire reign of Hazael, nearly 40 years, which coincided with the reigns of Jehu and his son Joachaz. According to the opening formula in 2 Kings chapter 13, verse 10, King Joash, the son of Joachaz, reigned over Israel for 16 years, probably between 802 and 786 BCE. He ascended to the throne at a time when the entire area west of the Euphrates River was undergoing a sharp change linked to the change of king in Assyria and in Aram, very close to the time when he himself acceded to the throne. As already described in the previous chapters, when the power dynamic between Assyria and Aram changed, this directly impacted the fate of the kingdom of Israel. A weak Aram allowed space for the development and growth of the kingdom of Israel, and was largely a common goal for both Assyria and Israel. In 809 BCE, King Ardad-nirari III came to power in Assyria, and he continued to reign for 26 years until 783 BCE. A few years later, probably in 806 BCE, Hazael died after about 36 years of reign in Aram Damascus, during which he established his kingdom as the strongest leading power in Syria. His son, Ben-Hadad, ascended to the throne in Damascus. Evidence of this is found not only in Assyrian inscriptions, but also in three notes that seal the story of the death of the prophet Elijah and the description of the reign of Joash, king of Israel, and present the fulfillment of his prophecy to Joash. This is in chapter 13, verses 22 to 25. I'm quoting. Now Hazael, king of Aram, oppressed Israel all the days of Joachaz. When Hazael, king of Aram, died, Ben-Hadad, his son, became king in his stead. Then Joash, the son of Joachaz, took again from Ben-Hadad, the son of Hazael, the cities which he had taken from Joachaz, his father, in war. Three times Joash defeated him and recovered the cities of Israel. End of quote. In the middle of this description, in verse 23, a late addition was inserted that was intended to explain Israel's salvation by God's mercy. This note reflects familiarity with the reality of the Babylonian exile and the historiographical notions of exilic and even post-exilic times. I'm quoting. But Yahweh was gracious to them and had compassion on them, and he turned toward them because of his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and would not destroy them, nor has he cast them from his presence until now. The Assyrian inscriptions indicate that after many years in which Assyria didn't pursue any campaigns beyond the Euphrates, Adad-nirari set out on his first campaign to the west as early as 805 BCE, apparently immediately after the death of Hazael. Facing the Assyrian army, a coalition of kings had gathered under the leadership of the king of Arpad in northern Syria, in which Aram Damascus was a key member along with other kingdoms. When the king of Kumuch refused to join the alliance, his kingdom was attacked by the members of the North Syrian alliance. However, Adad Nirar's inscription suggests that he came to the aid of the attacked kingdom and won a decisive victory in the war. In light of the massive and immediate Assyrian threat, Ben-Hadad tried to organize a large southern alliance which would include all the kingdoms in Syria. The kingdom of Hamat refused to take part in the alliance, and as a result, the Aramean army waged war against it and besieged its capital city. This time, too, the king of Assyria came to the aid of the attacked kingdom, and this is in 804 BCE. He struck the kingdom of Arpad, and in light of the danger, Ben-Hadad had to stop the war against Hamat. The effort of Ben-Hadad, king of Aram Damascus, to coalesce a large regional alliance against the threat of Assyrian invasion continued in the following years, 803, 802 BCE. Through these endeavors, he also tried to force Joash, king of Israel, to join the alliance. These efforts by the Aramean could be linked to the Aramean siege of Samaria described in Elijah's story cycle. In this case as well, Adad Nirari responded with a military campaign in 803 BCE, as a result of which the army of Damascus was forced to remove the siege from Samaria, which was perceived in the prophetic story as a miraculous rescue of the city and a miraculous disappearance of the Aramean army, which later suffered a severe defeat at the hands of the Assyrians. Similar to the campaigns of Shalmaneser III conducted in 841 and 833 BCE, Adad Nirari also persisted onward from Damascus to the border of Israel and Tyre on Mount Carmel. In the following year, 802 BCE, he reached the coast of Lebanon and established Assyrian control over the entire region. In this campaign, Aram Damascus was struck and enslaved by Assyria and had to pay a heavy tribute. All the kingdoms that were under its control and protection became Assyrian vassal kingdoms, and the Assyrian documents also include Philistia and Edom in the list of vassal kingdoms. At this point in history, clearly the balance of power in the southern Levant had changed. The kingdom of Israel had been freed from the Aramean yoke and became the central regional power. The meaning of the general historical picture that was described now is that Joash came to power in the year of the turning point when Aram Damascus was damaged and weakened. We can tie this to the prophetic story in the second book of Kings, chapter 13, verses 14 to 19, which opens with Joash's approach to Elisha. I'm quoting, "Now, when Elisha had fallen sick with the illness of which he was to die, Joash, king of Israel, went down to him and wept before him, crying, 'My father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen.'" At the story's center in verse 17, the prophet's instruction to King Joash to shoot an arrow through the eastern window, saying, I'm quoting, "Yahweh's arrow of victory, the arrow of victory over Aram. For you shall fight the Arameans in Aphek until you have made an end of them." We can assume that this was the battle in which Joash took advantage of the blow suffered by the Arameans from Assyria, and in which the balance of power between the two kingdoms changed after 40 years of Aramean hegemony. Another Assyrian campaign conducted in 796 BCE finally broke the power of Aram Damascus. As a result of this defeat, it became enslaved to Assyria. The geopolitical space that opened up was filled by two kingdoms, Hamat and Israel. However, Hamat's position in the center of Syria endangered the Assyrians. Therefore, already in 796 BCE, they set out on a military campaign against it, intent to curbing its power. In the following years, additional Assyrian campaigns were conducted to this region. In contrast, the Kingdom of Israel was located far to the south. Perhaps the existence of a strong Israelite kingdom in the area corresponded to the Assyrian interests, as it was a counterweight to the possibility of Aram Damascus restoring its power and reinventing itself as a mighty dominant kingdom in the region. What did biblical historiographers know about the days of Joash's reign and the great turning point that occurred in the history of the kingdom of Israel in this era? Unlike previous chapters in the history of the kingdom, about which they lacked all information, had only little information or had blurry information that they couldn't clearly tie to a specific kings and times periods, the historiographers had two clear, explicit sources regarding Joash. These sources testify first to the great salvation from the Aramean yoke, and second, to the strengthening of Israel and its transformation into the strongest, most dominant kingdom in the entire region. The information was clear, as was its link to the days of King Joash. Yet, the historiographer consciously and deliberately chose to disconnect this information from the description of Joash's reign, although the two stories were inserted later and the king's name clearly appeared in them. The question here is not about what was told or left untold, but why what was told was not placed in its natural and correct placement. Why weren't the two stories in which Joash played a central role as someone who led Israel at a historical turning point connected to the days of Joash himself, but rather cut off from his time and placed outside the regnal formulae that describe the years of his reign in such a short, casual, and almost detail-free manner? In this chapter, I suggest that just like the historiographers disconnected Elijah's story cycle from the reign of King Joash of Israel, they also decided to disconnect from that description the severe defeat that Joash inflicted on King Amaziah of Judah at Beth Shemesh, which included the demolition of large sections of the wall of Jerusalem and the looting of the city. By moving this story from the description of the reign of the victorious king of Israel to the description of the reign of the losing king of Judah, Joash was stripped of the honor reserved for the victors, and the arrogance of Amaziah, king of Judah, is accepted as punishment and as the main reason for the defeat he suffered. In this way, the historiographers created a distorted picture of the days of Joash as a king whose reign was empty and whose achievements, which couldn't be ignored, are scattered outside the regnal formulae that defines the days of his reign. All that remains in the description devoted to Joash's reign are four verses, two verses of an opening formula and two verses as a closing formula. The opening formula in 2 Kings 13, verses 10 and 11, provides the most basic details about the time and the duration of his reign, and a standard negative theological evaluation formula regarding Joash, similar to all the other kings of Israel. And I'm quoting, in the 37th year of Joash, king of Judah, Joash, the son of Joachaz, began to reign over Israel in Samaria. And he reigned 16 years. He also did what was evil in the sight of Yahweh. He didn't depart from all the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he made Israel to sin, but he walked in them. End of quote. The opening formula is followed immediately by the closing formula in verses 12 and 13, which is also completely standard except for a small supplement which hints to the additional information that the author had but chose not to insert it here. The supplement also refers to the broad description of their events later. And I'm quoting, "Now the rest of the acts of Joash and all that he did and the might with which he fought against Amaziah, king of Judah, are they not written in the book of Chronicles of the kings of Israel? So Joash slept with his fathers, and Jeroboam sat upon his throne, and Joash was buried in Samaria with the kings of Israel." Notably, there is an unusual complete repetition of Joash's closing formula in the next chapter, 2 Kings chapter 14, verses 15 and 16, after the description of the battle between him and King Amaziah of Judah as part of the biblical historiographer's message. I will discuss this later. Immediately after the opening and closing formulae about the days of Joash's reign, again, 2 Kings 13, 10 to 13, a prophetic story is presented in which Joash is at the center, but it is placed after the closing formula, historiographically cut off from the days of Joash's reign, and not a single detail of it is included in the description of his days. There is a symbolic and clear statement in this, which seeks to disconnect the orderly description of the history of the kings of Israel from this event, with the event being displaced from its correct location in the text between the opening and closing formulae of the description of the days of the king Joash. As mentioned, this is a prophetic story that describes the death of Elisha. It shows a close relationship between the king and the prophet, and even the admiration and respect that Joash had for the prophet Elisha. As a part of this relationship, the prophet alludes to the salvation of Israel from the hands of Aram Damascus, and even describes the number of victories Israel will have over Aram. And we read it, and I can just quote it from chapter 13, verse 19. "You will strike down Aram only 3 times. Moreover, it described the location of the central battle where Israel will be freed from the yoke of Aram in verse 17. "For you shall fight the Arameans in Aphek until you have made an end of them." End of quote. Already in the previous chapter, we described the conscious choice by the historiographer to disconnect the Elijah story cycle from the days of the Nimshi dynasty, although it is clear to any reader that Elisha was active during the days of Jehu and Joachaz, up until the beginning of the days of Joash, during which, according to the prophetic story in chapter 13, he passed away. The reality that emerges from the description does not fit the placing of Elijah's story cycle during the days of Joram, the son of Ahab, since these stories express the supremacy that the Arameans had over Israel, which included the presence of Aramean military units within the territory of the kingdom of Israel, raids, ambushes, and even sieges of the city of Dothan and the capital Samaria. The assumption discussed in the previous chapter is that the biblical historiographer received an edited collection of stories in which the stories of Elijah and Elisha were linked into this one sequence whereby Elisha is presented as Elijah's successor. This connection between the two prophets and the story of Elijah's ascension to the heavens and the transmission of the spirit of prophecy from Elijah to Elisha was more powerful and important than the historical information contained within the story. Since Elijah's story cycle is closely related to Ahab, the historiographer placed Elisha's stories in the days of Joram, Ahab's successor, and possibly finding support for this decision in the role that Elisha plays in the story of the campaign against Moab in the days of Joram, and even more so in the story of Elijah's role in Jehu's rebellion. Conclusion presented in the previous chapter is that the emphasis on continuity between Elijah and Elisha, apparently resulting from the historiographer's use of a scroll featuring an editing version of the stories, was the main cause of the historically incorrect placement of the description of Elisha's days. The disconnection of the story of the prophet's death from the sequence of the stories about him and its placement next to the description of Joash was due to the central role which the king played within the story. However, the decision to insert it after the closing formula and not between the opening and the closing formulae is a literary and ideological decision that stems, in my opinion, from the historiographer's personal assessment to King Joash. Immediately after the story of Elisha's death, in the second book of Kings, chapter 13, verses 14 to 21, and the comments that testify to the fulfillment of the prophet's prophecy to King Joash of Israel regarding the salvation from Aram, the three victories of Israel and the historical explanation of what occurred after the death of Hazael and the ascension of his son Ben-Hadad to the throne, this is in verses 22 to 25, we are given the opening formula for the days of King Amaziah of Judah in chapter 14, verses 1 to 4, from which it appears that he acceded to the throne in Judah near the time when Joash ascended to the throne in Israel, and I can quote, in the second year of Joash, the son of Joachaz, king of Israel, Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah, began to reign. Later, it is described how he executed his father's murderers immediately after gaining a foothold on the throne, this is in verses 5 and 6, and background is given regarding his war with Edom, in verse 7. All this leads the story to the central and most important part of the 29 years of Amaziah's reign, and this is in verses 8 to 14, the war between Israel and Judah. The victory over Edom made Amaziah believe in his strength and ability to face the Israeli army. Therefore, the story was inserted immediately after the description of Amaziah's victory over Edom. This placement offers a clear definition of the closeness of time between the two stories through the connective word as, then. And Amaziah's initiative is described in the expedition he sent to King Joash in verse 8. I'm quoting, then Amaziah sent messengers to Joash, the son of Joachaz, son of Jehu, king of Israel, saying, come, let us look one another in the face. This was a clear invitation to war, the reasons for which are also clear. Thus, Joash's answer was meant to illustrate Amaziah's weakness, as well as the mistaken reason for his excessive confidence. And this is in verses 9 and 10, and I'm quoting. And Joash, king of Israel, sent word to Amaziah, king of Judah. A thistle on Lebanon sent to a cedar on Lebanon, saying, give your daughter to my son for a wife. And a wild beast of Lebanon passed by and trampled down the thistle. You have indeed smitten Edom, and your heart has lifted you up. Be content with your glory, and stay at home. For why should you provoke trouble so that you fall, you and Judah with you? A possible interpretation of the meaning of this is that after Joash defeated Aram Damascus and inherited its position in the region, Judah became subordinate kingdom and perhaps even a vassal kingdom of Israel. Amaziah demanded to change his status and the status of Judah and become a king in equal status. A change that should be manifested in the marriage of his son, the heir to the throne, to the daughter of the king of Israel, similar to the marriage of Ataliah, daughter of Omri, with Joram, king of Judah, about two generations earlier. Joash rejected this demand with contempt, comparing it to the thistle request to marry the daughter of the cedar in Lebanon. This is perhaps also the reason why Joash is the aggressor and the initiator, and the war takes place in the territory of the kingdom of Judah, according to verse 11, and I'm quoting. But Amaziah would not listen. So Joash, king of Israel, went up, and he and Amaziah, king of Judah, faced one another in battle at Bethshemesh, which belongs to Judah. From a literary point of view, this description closes a circle, which began with the invitation of the king of Judah to the king of Israel to meet on the battlefield. Come, let us look one another in the face. And the meeting itself on the battlefield faced one another in battle. The outcome of the war expresses the great differences between the two kingdoms. Judah is defeated on the battlefield. King Amaziah is captured in Bethshemesh, likely after the city was conquered. And Joash, the king of Israel, ascended to Jerusalem and broke down the wall of Jerusalem for 400 cubits from the Ephraim gate to the corner gate. And he seized all the gold and silver and all the vessels that were found in the house of Yahweh and in the treasuries of the king's house, also hostages, and he returned to Samaria. A clue to answering why the description of the war between Israel and Judah was not inserted within the description of the day of Joash, king of Israel, is found in the repeated insertion of Joash's closing formula immediately after the end of the war, and this is in verses 15 and 16. The insertion of the closing formula of King Amaziah of Judah comes immediately afterwards in verses 18 to 22, and between these verses, a note was added. This note, while mathematically accurate and based on the years of the king's reigns as given in the opening formulae, it is biased from the literary and ideological perspective and reflects the aim of the historiographers and their bias against Joash. And I can read from verse 17. Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah, lived 15 years after the death of Joash, son of Joachaz, king of Israel. These words suggest that the king of Israel was marked in the eyes of the Jerusalemite writers because he was the only one of the kings of Israel who captured the king of Judah on the battlefield, who captured a city in Judah and destroyed part of the wall of Jerusalem. Despite the information the historiographer had about Joash's successes as someone who was close to the prophet Elisha, in whose days Israel was freed from the yoke of Aram, and above all, who won a complete victory in the war against Judah, they refused to give him the credit and didn't insert these stories into the frame of the regnal formulae about the days of his reign. In my opinion, they got the idea for this from the decision to place Elijah's stories in the days of Ahaziah, the son of Ahab, in accordance with the ancient prophetic source that they placed within the historiographical description and which connected Elijah and Elisha to each other as two prophets who acted in sequence one after the other. In a similar way, the historiographers placed the story of Elijah's death after Joash's clothing formula, even though it was a central part of the story. And they also placed the story of Joash's victory within the story of Amaziah, the defeated Judean king, and not within the story of the victorious Israelite king. As a testimony to Amaziah's minor victory, the historiographer added another small jab at Joash and described how Amaziah continued to live another 50 years after Joash, a true fact, according to the data in the opening formulae, but a well-directed stab from a literary and conceptual perspective. This story is a wonderful testimony to a case where the question is not what was told or what was left untold, but why what was told was not placed where it so clearly belonged. The historiographers expressed their opinion about an important and central historical figure whose achievements and successes they knew well, but decided to try to eliminate from the main story about him. They conveyed a clear message and clarified their position regarding King Joash by detaching the stories from his day and placing them outside the regnal formulae describing his reign, demonstrably leaving the description of the years of his reign as a short, empty, casual one, almost devoid of details. In the next chapter, we will deal with the last of the great kings who reigned in Israel, Jeroboam II. We'll try to make sense of the great gap between his brief biblical description and the complex array of historical and archaeological data testifying to the strength and greatness of Israel during his reign, just one generation before the Assyrian destruction of the kingdom. See you in the next chapter.